Lecture 7, The Visual Process.
Aristotle begins his metaphysics with the statement, "All men by nature desire to know. An example is the delight we take in our senses, for even apart from their usefulness, they are loved for their own sake, and none more than the sense of sight." And I think there probably is general agreement that of our various senses, it is the visual sense that produces such great, great sources of information and brings us into direct daily contact with the most subtle features of the external world, giving us some of the most enduring images of a lifetime. So the sense of sight, the visual process in general, has been a subject of interest to artists, it's been a subject of interest to scientists, and of course with the advent of psychophysics and sensory psychology, it would become the subject of experimental inquiries in psychology from the 19th century right up to today. It is probably the most frequently studied of the sensory organs. The eye is the most frequently studied sensory system. Now, it's also a quite remarkable system. Just the eye as an optical device is something one can devote a lifetime to and still continue to find out new and interesting aspects of it. Here we have this little quasi-spherical entity hanging out of our heads. It's about an inch in diameter from front to back. It has a little lens hanging down inside it in a watery bath, in a sort of thick saline bath called aqueous and vitreous humors. It's a marvelous focusing device. The external world impinges on the part of the eye one can see, which is the cornea. The cornea doesn't change its shape. It refracts light and brings it to bear on the lens. The lens can change its shape, becoming more spherical or more elongated. And the entire process is designed to bring light from the external world to a point on the retina, which is at the back of the eye. And the retina itself is like a diminutive nervous system. In fact, the retina grows out of the neural ectoderm embryologically. It grows out of the same embryological substrate that the cerebral cortex will grow out of. And as we've learned through a century of research, some of the information processing characteristics of the retina actually match up with some of the general processing features of the nervous system as a whole. The system is designed to pick up electromagnetic radiation that falls in a range of wavelengths, roughly 360 to 760 millimicrons. That's thousandths of a millionth of a meter. The visual system picks up radiation that falls in that range of wavelengths. The shortest wavelengths are associated with light having a blue or purplish color. The longest wavelengths are those associated with the experience of red. When the wavelengths get longer than we can see, they move into the region called infrared, and when the wavelengths are shorter than those available to the visual system, they are in the region of ultraviolet. But between that range of 360 to 760 millimicrons, or thousandths of a millionth of a meter, the normal visual system can make nearly 200 distinct discriminations of differences in color and hue. So it's a remarkable instrument for distinguishing between wavelengths of light, which is to say the psychological correlates or equivalents of color. Now, the optics of focusing is itself a subject of requiring very, very specialized knowledge. I say that the whole point of the optics of the eye is to take light in the external world and bring it to bear on the retinal surface. Indeed, bring it to bear on a very, very little pitted region on the retinal surface known as the fovea. And any textbook that has a sketch of the eye will show the cornea, the lens, the fluids of the eye, the retina at the back, and then this little pitted area, the fovea. If you could imagine the retina as a 360-degree circle, which it isn't, the fovea would be about 40 minutes in size. It would be a little bit less than 1 degree. And within that little region are thousands and thousands of what are called receptor cells. Now, a word about receptor cells. All sensation, whether it's touch, hearing, taste, odor, all sensation begins with a specialized cell capable of responding to the particularities of that environmental event, a highly specialized cell. Those cells that respond to events in the external world and respond in such a way as to create signals that the nervous system can use are called receptors. In the visual system, there are two kinds of receptors on the retina, rods and cones. I'll get back to that in a moment. But I want to say something else about receptors, because they go by another name. They are also referred to, not only as receptor cells, they're also referred to as transducers. And the reason they're called transducers, any transducer, in electrical engineering, transducers are used all the time. A transducer is a device that will receive energy in one form and then pass it in a different form, transduce it into a different form. Now, the language of the nervous system is electrical. For events to take place within the nervous system, electrical signals have to be generated. Electrical impulses have to be generated. So whatever the external world is doing, for it to get recorded within our own nervous systems, there has to be some translation of the external event into electricity. All of the receptors in the animal kingdom take events in the external world and transduce them into electrical signals. One way or another, the transduction process involves the representation of an incoming stimulus in electrical form. Now, I said that the receptors in the visual system, primate visual system, there are some pure cone eyes and there are some pure rod eyes. We have a mixed retina, a retina that has two different kinds of receptors, rods and cones, and these two different classes of receptors serve different visual functions. This is part of what is referred to when the visual system, when the retina is referred to as a duplex structure, and when we refer to human vision as something answering to the so-called duplicity theory or duplex theory of visual function. That's because the rods and the cones have different properties. Now, cones are found in the fovea. There are no rods in the fovea. The fovea is that central point on the retina that has all of the light collected from the object you're actually focusing on. When you look at any object at all, if you hold your hand out in front of you and look at your thumbnail, that thumbnail, if it's clearly in view, is being brought to focus on the fovea. Within the fovea, within the human fovea, there are only cone receptors, only cone cells. As you move outside the fovea, you begin to pick up some rods also, and in fact, the further and further you move into the periphery, the further you move from the fovea, the higher the percent of rods, the lower the percentage of cones. In the extreme periphery of the retina, there are only rods and no cones. Now, what about the numbers here? There are about 130 million receptor elements or receptor cells in the human retina. About 126 million of them are rods. And about 4 million of them are cones, or 125 million to 5 million. In other words, rods greatly outnumber cones. This is going to have some interesting consequences. Remember now, rods are in the extreme periphery, and only rods are found there. Cones are within the fovea, and there are no rods found within the fovea. Now, the rods and cones make connections with a kind of interneural cell, a cell that joins the receptors to a genuine neuronal cell. These little connecting units are called bipolar cells. So what happens is that the rods and cones converge on bipolar cells. The bipolar cells then feed what is called a retinal ganglion cell. Now, the retinal ganglion cell is the first true neuron in the visual system. In fact, a neuron has a cell body and some receiving branches called dendrites, and then a terminal branch that actually carries electrical signals some distance. That terminal branch that comes out of the neuron is called an axon. So every neuron has its axon process in the visual system. The retinal ganglion cell, of course, has an axon. And what do you think that axon is? Well, each axon of a retinal ganglion cell, in fact, is a fiber in the optic nerve. That is, the axons all exit from the eye in the same place, running in a common pathway back into the brain in the form of the optic nerve. Now, here are some numbers that might give you pause. I said there are 130 million receptors, 130 million rods and cones. There are 1 million optic nerve fibers in a human optic nerve. Now, let's do the arithmetic on this. We have 130 million receptors, and we have 1 million optic nerve fibers per eye. So, obviously, there are rods and cones that must be sharing a common optic nerve fiber. In fact, there must be a substantial amount of pooling of rods and cones down to a single optic nerve fiber, which means if you take the optic nerve fiber as a channel that's carrying information, it must be carrying information from a number of receptors. This is where the layout of the retina becomes intriguing and quite predictive of the visual experience. It goes something like this. The receptors are the rods and cones. The rods and cones feed into bipolar cells. Bipolar cells feed into retinal ganglion cells. Within the fovea, there are only cones. Now, let me give you the ratio of foveal cones to foveal bipolar cells to foveal retinal ganglion cells. This is within the fovea only. Roughly, for every 3 foveal cones, there are perhaps a couple of bipolar cells. And for every couple of bipolar cells, there are about 3 retinal ganglion cells. A ratio receptor to bipolar to ganglion cell of 3 to 2 to 3. What that means, then, is that within the fovea, just about every foveal cone has its own optic nerve fiber carrying information. Now, as you leave the fovea, these ratios change wildly. Once you get into the periphery of the retina, for every hundreds and hundreds and thousands of rods, there are scores and scores of bipolar cells funneling down into a single retinal ganglion cell. So the ratio in the periphery may be many, many hundreds to one, do you see? Many hundreds of peripheral rods having their information carried by a single optic nerve fiber, whereas within the fovea, every cone can claim its own optic nerve fiber. What's the net effect? The net effect is that our visual acuity in the fovea is exquisitely precise because a stimulus moving across so much as 1 intercone distance will have its information carried by separate optic nerve fibers. Do you see? Whereas as you move into the periphery, a stimulus might be painted across a whole swath of peripheral retina, and all that information will be funneled down into a single optic nerve fiber. So, visual acuity is wonderfully great in the fovea, where we actually have focused vision. Well, does this mean that the peripheral retina is just a simple waste of time? No, it doesn't at all. Because watch what does happen. Watch what does happen as you move into the periphery. As you move into the periphery, if you hold your arm at a right angle to the line of regard as you're facing forward, you start bringing your hand around into the periphery, it won't be long before you'll see a wiggling finger. But if you go to the point where you will just notice something out there and hold up 2 or 3 or 4 fingers, you won't be able to count the number of fingers in the hand. You'll know something's there, but you won't know quite what it is. Whereas, of course, foveally, you'll get a perfectly clear picture. Now, what is bought by this arrangement? The following. Suppose we designed a system to report the presence of some minimum number of packets of light energy. We will call each packet a quantum. And let's say the system is designed so it won't respond any time a quantum shows up. For goodness sake, life would be a constant visual blooming buzz. Some critical number of quanta must arrive in a given period of time, at which point the system will respond and you will know light is present. Now, suppose that critical number is something like 5, which is to say, suppose you have to get 5 quanta per unit time in order for the system to respond that light is present. You hit 1 foveal cone with light. No response, it's only 1. You hit the adjacent foveal cone, and the adjacent foveal cone, and the adjacent foveal cone, and the adjacent foveal cone. You've now hit 5 proximate foveal cones with light, but no one of them has got more than 1, and therefore you're not going to get a response in the optic nerve, because the optic nerve is waiting for 5. But with foveal cones, you've got a separate optic nerve per foveal cone. What happens in the periphery? You hit a rod with 1, and a neighbor with 1, and a neighbor, and a neighbor, and a neighbor. But of course, those 5 rods are all funneling their information down into a single optic nerve fiber. So the system responds. What we say is that the peripheral retina is capable of great spatial summation of energy, which means the threshold is lower in the peripheral retina. You can see at a much lower intensity with out of the corner of your eye than you can looking head on. If you're out in total darkness, tracking around, trying to find something, hardly any light there at all, if any light shows up, you're going to find it first in the periphery. As you turn around and look to see what it is, it'll disappear. You've got to keep it out of view to keep it visually present at all. So we get much lower thresholds with our peripheral vision. We get much greater acuity with our central foveal vision. Now, in evolutionary terms, this isn't a bad way to have things. After all, if you're out there in the middle of nowhere and some large striped creature is sort of padding around and you're not quite sure what's going on, the first thing you want is a system that will pick up the presence of anything. Picking up the presence of anything, it then gets you to run like you know what. Later on, maybe when the sun comes up, you can take a look at a distance with good foveal vision and say, aha, it was a Bengal tiger, lucky me, or, oh well, it was just a paper bag blowing in the wind. But good peripheral vision is a great defensive mechanism. The peripheral field picks up most of the visual field out there. The important thing is to know that something's there. You can take appropriate action and then later more carefully reflect upon what it is. Now, there's something else, in addition to accounting for the precise visual acuity that foveal vision has and the relatively poor visual acuity in the periphery, the duplex nature of the retina also helps explain something else. Namely, peripheral vision is achromatic. You do not see color with stimuli presented to the rod-only regions of the retina. In fact, color is mediated by the cones only, so that we say rod vision is achromatic and cone vision is chromatic. Now, you might say to yourself, I don't think that's true because I've spotted things out of the corner of my eye and in very, very dim light, and I know very, very well that it was a red apple. But in fact, if you put subjects in a controlled environment and actually present a green apple in the extreme periphery in a very, very dimly lit room, they will tell you that what they see is a red apple. Because what they, quote, see, close quote, has very much to do with what they know is there. But if they have no idea what the object itself is, you can readily determine that their vision in the extreme periphery is indeed achromatic. Now, it's sometimes said in textbooks, and it shouldn't be said, that rod vision is achromatic because the cones do not respond differentially to the color of light. I don't want to get overly technical, but of course that's false. If you plot changes in the pigments of the rods as a function of the wavelength of incident light, the pigments, which themselves have color, obviously do respond differently to lights of different color. What we want to say is this: vision that is mediated by the rod system, is not color vision. And that has to do really with the optic nerve fibers that are tied in with the rods and where those optic nerve fibers go in particular regions of the brain. So we say the rod system does not feed information to portions of the brain that are responsible for the experience of color. The cones, however, contain different photopigments, and those different photopigments respond selectively to different colors. We say, in fact, that there are several distinguishable forms of photopigments, each giving rise to, or at least mediating, the experience of a different part of the color spectrum. Roughly speaking, the long wavelength end, which we would call the reddish colors, the medium wavelength portion, which we would see as the yellows and yellow greens, and the short wavelength portion of the spectrum, which would be where we would find light that's blue, violet, and so forth. It is from the overlapping function of these three systems that we then can see all of the intermediary hues. By the simultaneous activation of a red system, a green system, and a blue system, we get various combinations of hues and color. So the normally sighted person, the person with normal color vision, will actually detect the major components in any colored object, no matter what the color is. That is, that person will be sensitive to the long, the intermediary, and the short wavelength components of any hue or color. Any hue or color can be matched by the proper manipulation of those three regions of the spectrum. You can produce any color that you like by the appropriate mixture of lights from the long wavelength, the intermediate wavelength, and the short wavelength end. The fact that you can achieve any color outcome by manipulating only three primary colors is what is called the trichromatic theory of color vision. The normal color percipient has trichromatic color vision in that the normally sighted person, the person with normal color vision, will be able to detect and match any colored stimulus provided that person can manipulate the three points on the spectrum, the long wavelength point, the intermediate wavelength point, the short wavelength point. What do we say about people who don't have to manipulate three colors to achieve a match? They can achieve any match by manipulating two colors. In fact, the person giving this lecture is such a one, although it's not quite as bad as that. Well, the reason why some people only need to manipulate two colors to achieve a perfect match is because the system is not sensitive to the third color. That is to say, you don't have normal trichromatic vision, you have what is called dichromatic vision, and that is a characteristic form of color blindness. In the typical case, you don't have a true dichromatic person, you have someone who has a weakness in one or another region of the spectrum. Now, this is a sex-linked characteristic because it turns out that about 5% of the males and about one-half of 1% of the females have color vision deficiencies of the dichromatic variety. In much rarer instances, you have a person who can match any color by manipulating a single color. So that person not only does not have trichromatic vision, that person doesn't have dichromatic vision. Rather, that person has what is called monochromatic vision, just one color-sensing, color-processing system rather than three. And in the rarest cases, you actually have people who can match any color by manipulating only the brightness of a matching field because they don't see any color at all. And in that case, you would be dealing with someone who is a bona fide achromat or has achromatic vision. So the normal case is trichromatic. The more common form of color blindness is dichromatism. A rarer form is monochromatism. And then the absolute absence of color vision would be achromatism. Now, historically, the best explanation of the color processing capabilities of the visual system is the trichromatic theory. And the trichromatic theory, put simply, says this. The simultaneous activation of three color systems in vision, a long wavelength, an intermediate wavelength, and a short wavelength system. Let's call them a red-green-blue system, if you like, or a red-green-violet system. The simultaneous activation of an RGV set of processors, stimulating one of them more than another less than another, and various patterns and the like, is what gives rise to every and any color experience. The answer to the question, how can I see vermilion? How do I see plaids? How do I see these earth tones and the like? Well, you're simultaneously activating three systems, and it's the interplay among those systems that will give rise to all of the complexities and intermediary color forms. All right? Well, now this gives you a ready answer to the question, how will you account for dichromats? The two most common forms of dichromatism involve either an insensitivity in the red end or an insensitivity in the green end. If it's an insensitivity in the green end, it's referred to as deuteranomalous vision, and if it's an insensitivity in the red end, it's referred to as protanomalous vision. So the way you get the so-called deuteranope on this theoretical account is, the deuteranope is obviously missing a green system. Do you see? How do you get a protanope? How do you get someone insensitive to red light or anything in the long wavelength end? Well, this is obviously somebody missing the red system. And that was the happy state of affairs until it was observed in the 19th century that both deuteranopes and protanopes can see yellow normally. Now, if the experience of yellow is the result of the interplay of a red and green system, then anyone lacking either a red system or a green system shouldn't be able to see yellow at all. Now, what would men and women of common sense say? Oh, well, let's just say there's also a yellow receptor system, and so what the deuteranope and protanope have lost are green and red, but they still have yellow. That is, let's say instead of a trichromatic theory, there's a four-process theory. Why didn't people say? Well, actually, someone did propose that. Christine Ladd Franklin had proposed that. The principle of parsimony in science is such that if you can explain a lot of events through a simpler system, don't adopt or invoke a more complex system. So the name of the game was to try to account for these effects, staying with the tried and true trichromatic theory without going to a four-process or a five-process or an n-process theory. Well, it turns out that probably the best explanation of color vision is in terms of a three-process kind of mechanism. The standard trichromatic one that I talked about, which best matches up with what we know about the pigment chemistry of the rods and cones, or particularly of the cones, do you see? But color vision doesn't end in the retina. It continues back into the brain. Now the question is, how do we best represent the physiological response of the system to color? The electrical responses in the nerves and in the axons and in the brain and the like. The best explanation here seems to be this. A three-process system, but not a red-green-violet system. Rather, an opponent process system first proposed by Ewald Hering in the 19th century. And that system is as follows. The argument here is as follows. Color vision is mediated by pairs of opposing processes. A red-green opponent pair, a blue-yellow opponent pair, a light-dark opponent pair. Fatigue one, it has the same effect as exciting the other, which is why if you're exposed to a high-intensity green light, shut it off, turn on a screen, what do you see? A red afterimage. If you're exposed to a high-intensity yellow light, turn it off, look at a white screen, blue afterimage. Do you see an opponent process? Well, it looks very much like the electrophysiology of color vision follows this opponent process model, this opponent process theory, very, very closely, whereas the known pigment chemistry of the retina follows the classic trichromatic theory of color vision. So, we've got two theories, it turns out they're both right, and we've got a very, very good understanding of the basic chemistry and electrophysiology of the experience of color. Mediated first at the level of the retina, and then electrically coded in the right way by discharge patterns in the optic nerves that go back into the brain and feed the various relay stations and central stations for the visual process, culminating in the occipital cortex at the back of the head, part of the brain associated with all vision in human beings and particularly in color vision. Sensitivity. If you can get 5 or 6 quanta to the retinal layer, stimulating the cones directly, the ordinary percipient will see light. You can't get anything fewer than one quantum in the physical world. So as a quantum integrator, as a quantum detector, the human visual system is exquisitely sensitive. It's exquisitely sensitive to wavelength. It's exquisitely sensitive to shape and form and pattern. As a basic sensory device, you could hardly ask for anything better than what we've got, and we've got to make clear how we should take care of this system all the days of our lives.